This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old-school greats and new-school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
You have an efficient intellect, superior physical skills, no emotional impediments. There are Vulcans who aspire all their lives to achieve what you've been given by design.
You are half-human.
Yes.
Yet you have chosen a Vulcan way of life.
I have.
In effect, you have abandoned what I have sought all my life.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Positively Trek. We are happy to bring you our second component of the Data series, and with me to do that... Oh, I'm Barry DeFord, by the way, but with me to do that is the illustrious Mr. Dan Gunther. Dan, how you doing? How are you functioning? Are you at full operational capacity?
Greetings. I am operating within standard parameters.
That is optimal for the discussion that we are about to have.
Indeed.
I like how we utilized the conversation here, we're kind of breaking this up into two pieces, because I do think Data has a different flavor to some degree in terms of how he is portrayed cinematically and then in this sort of new Trek genre that we have now. And I mean, obviously it's going to be different. These are different times, right? We had a 90s iteration of Data, and now we have a, you know, cinematic late 90s, early 2000s, and then now sort of the 20-teens, 2020s. That's obviously going to make a big change in terms of how exactly we see this character. If he's exactly the way he was, that would be boring. But I want to really kind of delve into this, the cultural phenomenon, I guess, that is Data. And maybe we kind of did that with Kirk a little bit. I think there's obviously other characters we can do that. And the fact that there's a bunch of podcasts on this franchise, Star Trek's cultural impact is pretty much hard to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
So there is going to be some criticism on my end. And there is going to be some mention of what I would consider to be some missed opportunities. But at the same time, I think that being that we like to keep the criticism constructive and the conversation positive, this is all spoken with love. Mm-hmm. And so if I start ranting and railing, it's because I love something, right? Just last night, actually, my stepson was very upset that his favorite hockey team lost to another. It was the Oilers versus the Arizona or Phoenix Coyotes. And the Oilers lost, and my stepson was visibly angry and was saying things that I don't think he meant ultimately, but he still loves the Oilers. He still loves the team, though he said some things that I was like, sounds like you don't like the Oilers very much. And he's like, no, I love them. And so I think maybe if there are points where I start railing and being upset, understand that this isn't me trying to say that, you know, the new Star Trek is terrible or bad or anything like that. So throat clearing aside, how are you seeing this outlook on Data coming into our second chat? And are there any things you'd want to reflect on since we spoke?
There are a few things that I think are going to inform what we talk about from the previous conversation as well, that, you know, we're going to definitely revisit, or things that, you know, didn't necessarily come up that I think weigh on what's going on. But yeah, it is interesting. Like you say, there's kind of these two phases of Data. And I think in this discussion, we're going to be touching a little bit on the end of that first phase still a little bit, because we didn't really get to Nemesis last time, which I think is the pulling of the lever and the switch, obviously, right? That was the big change for Data going forward, and the the endless kind of quagmire that writers afterwards have to try and figure out a way around. So
I suppose that is a good point. I also like that you mentioned pull the lever, because to some degree, some people may shout wrong lever, but anyways.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, so I mean, Data up until Nemesis, I'd say, was kind of one thing. And I mean, he evolved. There was that evolution. He got the emotion chip. He evolved besides that, as we talked about in the last episode, with his android emotions and his growing to becoming human without, you know, the technological skyhooks and stuff like that. But his ultimate self-sacrifice in Nemesis, I think, is kind of a big touchstone that I want to touch on here.
Absolutely. And maybe just to kind of build on what you're saying there, I don't think we're necessarily alien to his belief in sacrifice, even in the previous movie, which was First Contact, where he sacrifices his human skin. Mm-hmm. He sacrifices something that he got, I mean, I would say dubiously, ultimately, and he makes the right choice by sacrificing something that he didn't get fairly. But I think that starts the exploration of Data, understanding that part of humanity is a recognition of mortality. And, you know, I'm sure being a robot android, he was able to calculate the risk, knowing that when he broke that vial of skin eating, whatever the heck, that ultimately gets the Borg Queen as well, after his amazing resistance is futile line, he understands that he's going to have to lose something that he gained. And to some degree, that's a really, really hard pill for humans to swallow, I think, in a lot of cases. Like, when you've got something, you think it's yours. And I think there's a sense of permanence that human beings wrongfully get. And it's funny that we do have these senses of permanence, of things being static and unchanging to some degree, especially for the fact that we all get to die at some point. And I don't want to get on like a dark note already, but he seems okay with that. In the sense that it's in the moment, but then later, of course, we get that realized a lot more strongly in that moment, realizing he can save Picard, but he can't save himself. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess he could save himself too, but at this point, Data's already gone through a pretty harrowing ordeal to get onto the Scimitar, onto the bridge, jumping across. Spoiler alert, I don't know. This is a very old movie. If you haven't seen it, and you're
22 years old now.
And if you're listening to a niche podcast like this and you haven't seen Star Trek Nemesis, I don't even know what to tell you, but that's interesting. Go watch it. You might not like it. Some people don't. It's all good. But I wanted to just bring up something right off the bat, that Brent Spiner obviously had a great role in how Data is portrayed and put together in that episode, I guess you could say, of Star Trek, which is the movie Nemesis. In a panel somewhat recently, I was able to find in my YouTube travels, Brent Spiner is asked about the death of Data in Nemesis, and he's pretty cool. And he says, like, I, you know, didn't really see the death as final, even when we were writing it, and it didn't really bother me, and it didn't concern me. And if that was the last movie, then it's a nice way to end it. And if it's not the last movie, then we'll rewrite him in somehow. And he was correct. Mm-hmm. So I think even sort of looking at that, and he was sitting next to Marina Sirtis, who would kind of backed him up by being like, well, Spock died a whole bunch and Kirk died a whole bunch and dying is this and that. And the guy who played Shaw recently is like, I'm Star Trek dead. Like, I'm not dead. So, and maybe the first time I ever experienced this idea of a loved or beloved character dying, and this is kind of before my delve deep into Star Trek, I used to read a lot of comic books. And one of the big comic books that I started with was The Death of Superman, and him, you know, just basically brawling with the weird creature Doomsday to the death to save Metropolis and all this sort of stuff. And we encounter this phenomenon in our pop culture where characters die, they die, but, like, I don't know, mm-hmm. the stakes kind of get loaded a little bit. And there's always something, right? There's always something that brings them back. And I think maybe there's something within the human condition that makes us see a return as important. I mean, even in some of our major religions, we have characters who die and come back. I think it's important to understand that this is something really deep within us, of killing something we love only to bring it back. Mm-hmm. Now, when Superman comes back, he's different. And I think, obviously, we see that with Data as well. So, yeah, this is my opening salvo.
No, that's awesome. And I mean, yeah, there's definitely a cynicism in pop culture now when it comes to death and that sort of thing. And I'm speaking as someone who never really got into comic books in his youth, but recently have started reading a lot of comic books and
finally
kind of seeing that culture and stuff. Like right now in the Marvel comics, I'm not really reading this series or anything, but they had a mini series, The Death of Magneto, and they've already solicited issues in other series while that series is coming out that feature his resurrection, and they advertise it in the, you know, publisher blurb for the books, right? So it's like, at what point is it like just understood that these characters come back and it's not permanent and it's just a thing that we're doing? You know, in the past it would be like, oh, he had a life-changing experience doing this thing, and now it's, well, we killed him, but this is how he comes back, so don't worry. I feel like there was less of that at the time of Nemesis, and I mean, you know, Brent Spiner's experience while he's filming it and that sort of thing. And we had, like you'd said, Marina Sirtis talking about the precedent in Star Trek. It was maybe a little less just read 22 years ago as it is now, but it was definitely there. I do remember also fairly shortly after Nemesis came out, and by that I mean like 2009, 2008, somewhere in there, I saw Brent Spiner at a convention and he fields that question a lot. Like, you know, why did they kill Data off? Are you mad they killed Data off? Blah, blah, blah. And his answer at that time, I remember, was, well, they killed us all off. That was the last movie. They're not making right? anymore. So what's the difference? Like, I died, but so did everyone else as far as you're concerned. And it was a little bit glib and a little bit kind of like a frustrating
Brent Spiner answer. Glib?
Yeah, right? What? Shocking.
Goodness.
But it was an interesting position. Like, it, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, what's the difference between the status of Data versus the status at the time of Jean-Luc Picard? I guess the difference is you can put Picard in comics and books. And interestingly, they found ways to get Data into comics and books after that. And this is, again, my bias showing through. I really love the way that the novels, the post-Nemesis novels, brought Data back. I like it better than what they did on television. But anyway, all of that aside, yeah, there's definitely an impermanence and a cynicism when it comes to the status of death. And like you said, Shaw himself, right? I'm just Star Trek dead. I'm not dead dead.
Exactly. Well, and that actually kind of brings me to a bit of a rant. And this is the first rant of the episode. So welcome to Barry's Rant Corner. There is a death, and Brent brings that up quite well by saying that by canceling a series, by ending a season or a series or inside of a franchise, there is sort of a death in the sense that you aren't going to see these characters do any more adventures. And you and I are currently staring down the barrel now of not only a season 5 cancellation of Discovery, but also one of Star Trek Lower Decks, which I find, in all of the bad choices made by CBS, Paramount, yada, yada, anyone who's ever owned the franchise of Star Trek, it seems that the biggest problem I have with NU Trek or New Trek or whatever is the fact that they are so incredibly ready to pull the plug at any given moment on what are really strong series and series that, you know, kind of come into their own. Like, I guess you can never really argue what the potential of something is if it never even gets to explore that potential. But if you go by the series of, say, Star Trek Discovery, and, you know, I would give Discovery a bit of a hard time, kind of, it had a bit of a shaky start, right? Sure. So did The Next Generation.
Yes.
And if we think about how long it took for that to come into its own and everything like that and evolve and change over time, I really think the best is yet to come, and that we could see something really great come out of both Lower Decks and Discovery if we just kept it going. Now, I know money is a thing and there was an actor's strike and everything's more expensive, and it's pretty clear that our corporate people who run things aren't interested in what we enjoy. They're interested in what we have in our pocket, and that's basically it. Even in that sense, And forgive me, I don't have exact numbers or knowledge of this, but from what I understand, the Star Trek streaming, or the streaming of Star Trek, is done a lot. And I do believe that a certain amount of revenue comes out of that. And for me to think of, is Lower Decks really that unprofitable? It's an animated show, right? Animated is easier, always. And actually, I thought to myself, to some degree, maybe animated would become the new wave of the future, but then they canceled Prodigy, and now they're canceling this. And so it seems like this resurgence of Star Trek that started in, what, 2017 is kind of getting snuffed out more than it's dying a natural death, like it kind of did with the TNG cinematic universe, right? It kind of just ended, right? And then you had Enterprise, which, again, though it was getting better, I can kind of better understand why it didn't do as well. And in this case, in the world of streaming, it just feels like they're kind of putting the series down more than they're letting it go out to pasture, kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You talked about your stepson saying some things that maybe he didn't necessarily mean about something that he loves. And I've been cursing Star Trek a little bit the last day or so, just because of what it means to me personally. And I mean, I think I posted on Twitter something like, because they did the thing where they jammed the good news and the bad news together, right? They renewed Strange New Worlds for season 4. Season 3 is still upcoming. But in that same press release said, and also season 5 of Lower Decks will be its last. And I think I tweeted something along the lines of, I'm very happy for Strange New Worlds, very stoked for that. I can't even touch the Lower Decks news right now because it hurts too much. Like, I can't even interact with that right now. I can't, no. You know, it sucks. Like, this thing that I love, it hurt me yesterday. I'm going to be honest, you know, but I'm going to love this final season of Lower Decks, I'm sure. And, I'm going to treasure it. And it sucks that these decisions have been made, and we need to send a moopsie into the Paramount offices and find whoever is responsible for this.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I guess, you know, kind of moving from the concept of Nemesis being sort of an end to that sort of first component of Data's story. And I would still argue that the cinematic features of TNG do have a markedly different flavor to the TV shows, with the exception of Insurrection. I do actually believe that Insurrection is an episode of Star Trek that made it to the silver screen, personally. It would have worked really well as a just standard issue, and I think it gets a lot of heat because it's more of an episode of Star Trek than it is a cinematic feature. But we can argue that maybe another day. Yeah.
Oh, one final thing I want to say about Nemesis as well. Speaking of cynicism and these kinds of things, the marketing of that movie and how it was set up drives me nuts whenever I read about this, because they were like, this might be the final movie. It might not. We'll see how it goes. Down to them picking the tagline for the movie as, a generation's final journey begins. Because if they could make another one, it could be a generation's final journey continues. But like, just the cynicism of that, you know, with that kind of sort of Damocles hanging over that cast for that movie, like, how terrible must that have been? And then it opens, and I will continue to rail against this fact for my life because it drives me nuts that on opening weekend it was beat by Made in Manhattan, the Jennifer Lopez movie.
Hey, can't beat J-Lo.
That's all I have to say about that, in the words of Forrest Gump.
Well, and I think maybe to some degree the energy had been kind of really toned down in terms of that. And I almost wonder if it was just sort of a natural conclusion that component of Star Trek was finding its ending. And maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, it was a pretty hard time to be a Star Trek fan, not in the sense that we're like some kind of oppressed group or something, but there you're looking at like Star Wars was really kicking up a lot of steam and a lot of speed. And of course that had its own sort of deleterious outcomes in that period of time. But
yeah, kind of a young, dynamic, fast paced cast and like all this stuff going on. And, you know, 2002, the TNG crew, I mean, I'm, you know, a bunch of older folks on a ship doing a mostly talking type adventure like that. As much as I love Star Trek, and you know I do, I'm not criticizing it for being that, but that's what it is. And stack it up against, you know, the prequels of Star Wars coming out, and no matter your opinion on the prequels, and I have several, when you put the movies next to each other, what is a, you know, 18 to 24 year old moviegoer going to gravitate more? All other things being equal, what are they going to be attracted to?
Well, and what got Star Trek up and running again, but basically J.J. Abrams' resume for a Star Wars movie, mm-hmm. right? 2009 Trek, as much as that was like revitalizing for me in terms of getting back into Star Trek and all of that jazz, it did not have the same pace as really anything Star Trek-y before that, right? That, again, 2009 Trek to me is a carnival ride. You get on and it takes you places and you're just along for the ride, and it's so busy and it's so supercharged. It was kind of like shock paddles to the franchise.
Yeah.
And it worked, right? It totally worked. And you know, as much as it isn't really thought about or spoken about, other than kind of hinted at every now and again for us, like, dyed-in-the-wool Star Trek fans of like, ooh, there might be another movie coming up, but there won't be. But there will, but there won't be. But there will, but there won't be. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. I do have to say that Discovery and a few of the other more recent Star Trek films have tried to capture that speed and haste and intensity, and they've really fallen flat. And so that's where I'm going to move into talking a bit about Data again. We're still talking about Data, everyone. Sorry, a bit of a meandering pace here, but we digress. Daj and Soji specifically. Mm-hmm. I won't talk about their other sister who comes in later just yet. I think that they really tried to pick up that haste and pace for the starting of Picard. And by making Data's daughters a central figure, I think that's a really fascinating way of exploring Data through his progeny, I guess you could say. But they murk one in like the first episode and don't really do much with the second one with Soji pretty much afterward. Like she's sort of discarded as a character, and we didn't really get to know her that well to begin with. And so I do worry that to some degree there was an attempt at kind of trying to reimagine Data in a new way and reimagine him in terms of his family. And it was so busy and convoluted and rushed. I kind of actually felt Lal had more development than they did ultimately. And it, maybe it's the episodic nature of Star Trek: The Next Generation that you kind of accept the fact that you're not going to see this character necessarily afterward, and that things will kind of be resolved in the end. And it's a quick episode, right? But I don't really feel like I got to know Daj very well whatsoever. And when she died, I don't really feel like the stakes were very high. Like she's, oh, now she's dead. Okay. And then suddenly, oh, there's another one. And it's like, what? Okay. Mm-hmm. Then that's also a thing, I guess. And so I feel like there was a really rushed reintroduction of Data back into the story of Star Trek again. I think they catch the football kind of at the end, and they do a really good job in season three. But yeah, what are your thoughts about Data's daughters? Are you on my, are you with me on the, maybe it's a little bit rushed, or do you have a bit more of a positive outlook on the two of them?
Yeah, I agree. It was definitely rushed. It was a little bit frenetic, head whipping back and forth in between what's happening there. And like you said, the first one, Daj, she's barely in half an episode before she's kind of taken out, or well, I guess that first episode. And then Soji, I think, is a really fascinating character, and I really wanted to know more about her. There's some great moments with her throughout that first season. I think the episode Nepenthe is definitely a high point of that season, not just because we get to see Riker and Troy and their life on this world, but there's a lovely scene between Soji and the Riker's daughter, Kestra, where they're talking, yes, about Data and this sort of thing. I just, there's some really quiet, lovely moments in that episode. I'm really disappointed. Like, I was so excited when Picard season two came on and she's there, and we learned she's doing this goodwill tour for synths around the Federation. I'm like, oh, this is cool. Like, let's see. And that's it. That's just in the first episode. That's the last we ever see of her, which is disappointing. I do like the idea that she's out there somewhere. Like, Issa Briones is awesome. She's in the, yep, Star Trek universe. Bring her back. Like, if Star Trek Legacy ever happens, like, at least have her guest star for a few episodes, because she's incredible. I think they really had something special with her.
Yeah. And maybe this is because of Discovery trying to be so incredibly different at the start. And I'm not going to deny that there was a pretty hefty, you know, backlash and division among the fandom of, you know, is this an acceptable thing, the changes and stuff. And we'll get into change later. But I feel like we were like trying like Dorito flavors kind of at the start of them being like, well, do you like this flavor? Or do you like that flavor? And I felt like the episodes were almost working as a focus group of like, oh, well, the reaction to this character wasn't as good. So the board has decided to remove it. We're going to go in another direction. It's like, but you're leaving like all of these threads. And, you know, you and I have spoken about threads left undone just recently. Mm-hmm. And I'm surprised we didn't actually talk about this at length.
Yeah.
Of the Soji thread, because she's a big threat, and she does just sort of, like you say, like just sort of pop her head up in season two and be like, hi everyone, I'm doing this cool, bye, and that's it. Like, she's just here and gone.
Yeah. And shows up as a completely unrelated other character, which we'll get to.
Yeah. Well, and again, that's another thing about the data phenomenon I find in this second iteration is there's a lot of them. There's so many datas. There's so many versions and aspects that it did get a little busy there for me. Mm-hmm. To some degree. I mean, we don't necessarily have to deal with too many iterations of data in the second season. But by the third season, you know, he's literally in conflict with himself. Esque, I guess you could say, like not fully.
Yeah. We should definitely talk about his second death though in season one first though, because like I did really like this. Like there's some great moments in that season finale of Picard season one, where Data is basically kind of still alive in the fact that they recovered these memory engrams and they're sitting on this computer. And he's kind of in this purgatory, in this limbo that he wants released from. And Picard basically grants him euthanasia. It's a really wonderful scene. And I thought that was a really nice button on the character. And I remember at the time, at the end of season one, thinking how disappointed I was with Data's death in Nemesis and how satisfied I was with his death here at the end of Picard season one. It felt much more meaningful for the character. And I didn't mention this with Nemesis, but we have a friend that we've been, you know, showing all of Star Trek to and watching all together and stuff. And we got to Nemesis and Data was her absolute favorite character. And in the room, as the movie's progressing and we're getting towards the end and we know what's coming and we can see like, this truck is about to hit our friend and there's like nothing we can do. And it happened and she had to get up and go to the bathroom for about 20 minutes. She was bawling and was like embarrassed and we felt so bad. And Data's death in Nemesis didn't hit me like that.
No,
unfortunately. And it should have, because he's a beloved character and it should have had that impact on me. And, the fact that it did for my friend, and I won't name her, I won't out her here. Yeah. That's her story. But like that really touched me. And it, you know, you can kind of live vicariously through another human being. And that was really touching. The Data death at the end of Picard season one didn't hit me that hard, but it hit me harder than the Nemesis one did. It felt more meaningful. It felt more real. And I really applauded that show for how they handled Data, almost as if saying like, look at the botched job that that Nemesis did with this. Let's fix it.
Yeah.
And I appreciate
it. And I think leaving Data in limbo, I think really was kind of the whole point, right? Because with B4, you know, you knew that there was a certain amount of his essence being maintained and held onto in the comic books. That of course happens a lot. I think to some degree that's explored in the novels, though I haven't read those. But I think Data gets what I would consider his swan song. Mm-hmm. It is very much like losing a person tragically versus losing a person on their deathbed. And with Data, we kind of get both in that respect, where, you know, the heartfelt goodbye between him and Picard is very much drawn out and given its due. And both Sir Pat and Brent Spiner do such a fantastic job sort of shutting the book on their characters in certain ways, because of course Picard also kind of undergoes a certain type of death as well, or at least a concept of sacrifice that we would understand. Now again, the stakes really weren't that high, and actually I felt a lot more substance, yes, to Data's death. And again, to some degree, there's parts of it that reminded me of the death of Hal in Space Odyssey 2001.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So the slow kind of pulling away of the pieces. But also, yeah, it instead of maybe a euthanasia, I think of, you know, the death of somebody who's terminally ill. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, yeah, you kind of lose bits of them. And it kind of gives you a better understanding of death itself, that it isn't some immediate phenomenon, that it is actually a process, much like birth and life are also processes. And the amount of time that we spend on this world is kind of up to us in terms of how we live it. And I think Data chooses to end things in a very meaningful way, that the writers very meaningfully ended him, and you know, him kind of sort of fading out the way he does. Yeah, it gives us a lot to ponder. And I think the pacing there compared to the starting of the series is done very, very well. And yeah, they kind of closed the chapter on him quite nicely. Mm-hmm. So I'd be interested to know what other people think. And you kind of telling us the story about your friend and her reaction. I would love, if she's interested, to even have her on the show after she's seen the ending of Star Trek Picard season one, to kind of give us how did that one feel comparatively, right? Like, how are you doing now? And what do you think? So whomever you may be, I will say the offer is out there. I don't know if that's possible, but I think that'd be pretty neat to get that impression.
The unfortunate part is we weren't together for the end of Picard season one just because of timing. We were all watching together weekly and stuff. And then COVID hit about 2/3 of the way through Picard season one. So I know, like, she's seen it and she's watched it on her own and stuff, but we were kind of denied the vicarious nature of watching it with her. So,
well, I mean, we can still, that they say hindsight is 20/20, mm-hmm. and you know, having that much time to think about it, I would actually be even more interested if she's had time to kind of chew on it as well. Like you and I being old guard Star Trek fans have had quite some time to look back and think about it and mull over and obsess over a lot of different aspects of the series. Yeah.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode of Positively Trek is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon. A special thank you to our Constitution class supporters, Jim Stoffel, Joyce Mirren, and Paul D. Kinnear. To help out with the podcast, visit patreon.com/positivelytrek, where for a small monthly donation, you can get early access to ad-free episodes, shoutouts, exclusive content, associate producer credits, and more. Thank you so much for listening, and live long and prosper.
Maybe we can get into that now, is that Data really isn't just Data. Data is Lore. Data is Lal. Data is Soji. Data is all of the Soongs. Mm-hmm. and so maybe to kind of start this conversation, I've gotten back into contact with some members of my family who, just due to a lot of circumstances that are completely unimportant to anyone listening, I've not really been in touch with recently. And as of recently, I've become a lot more in touch with. And so one of my cousins our mothers are sisters. She and I have rekindled a very close bond and friendship, I think, in a lot of ways, through our families and through our kids and our spouses, that has really made me feel fortunate and happy to have rekindled that. But it's interesting because, you know, having grown up with my cousin and now seeing her, it's funny that there are moments in time where as she turns her head a certain way or lifts her hand a certain way, I see her mom. And her mom is terminally ill, sadly, is dying very slowly, unfortunately. But she's being given all of the dignity she deserves, I will say that. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, us interacting as adults, no longer children, I see aspects of my own mom in me as we're interacting with one another. And I even see aspects of myself, and now that I've had time to get to know my cousin as a full-fledged adult who's a parent and this, all those sorts of things like me, I'm also seeing certain characteristics that the two of us share. And I'm maybe getting into this, like, what are the characteristics of individuality and sort of the essence of persona? Because we are different individuals who have very different viewpoints and outlooks and ways of handling things and circumstances, but we both have a certain essence of persona that are unmistakable. And even my wife was like, you guys are definitely cousins, like to the level that I wonder, like people would wonder if you're siblings. And she's very good in the sense that she and her cousins on her mom's side are also extremely close and have, you know, different sort of essence of persona that they share. So I take her opinion very seriously because I think she has the appropriate context to recognize that. So, you know, obviously Brent Spiner has played the vast majority of all of these roles. And I would say that the actors who aren't Brent Spiner have done an extremely good job of doing that. Like we just talked about Issa Briones, remember her little head tilt? Mm-hmm. Oh, that was perfect, yep. Right? Like in season one head tilt, the Data head tilt, I was just like, oh, you nailed it, dude. Well done. Like way to do the character justice mm-hmm. in that respect. So what do you think about his extended family? And do you think that maybe in this regard, seeing Data rather than just simply the character and more kind of like a vibe, is that how we can kind of see Data going forward?
Sure. Yeah. Data's extended, like this starts early, right? So, I mean, TNG season one, we meet Lore, the evil brother is kind of the trope they're playing with there. Right. I think the next relative we meet, oddly enough, is his grandfather, the guy yes. who trained Noonien Soong. Everything, like, I mean, not related, obviously, but everything is placed in this familial context right away. You know, call me grandfather, all of this stuff. And mm-hmm. I think that's the writer's way of doing a little shorthand humanizing of Data, right? Mm-hmm. Because he's a piece of technology, but let's put this in terms that are humanizing and make him more human. And then, of course, the episode Brothers, we get the tour de force of Brent Spiner playing Data, Lore, and Dr. Noonien Soong, where we finally meet him. And like that was yes. very celebrated. Little did we know that, you know, all these years later, you look up Soong on Memory Alpha and it comes right? up. Soong could refer to Adam Soong, a doctor of genetics in the 21st century. This is Picard season two. Eric Soong, a doctor of genetics in the 22nd century, showed up in Enterprise. Corey Soong, daughter of Adam Soong, played by Issa Briones, the only one on this list. Well, actually, one of two on this list not played by Brent Spiner. Noonien Soong, of course, the creator of Data. Alton Soong, the son of Noonien Soong that we meet in at the end of Picard season one. And even Juliana Soong, the wife of Noonien Soong, who is Data's quote-unquote mother and is referred to as such and accepted as such, and who turns out to be an android herself. So mm-hmm. this extended family, that's just the Soongs going from there. You know, like I said, Lore, there's B4, and then there's all these androids of Capalius colony, mm-hmm. which...
Cousins.
cousins? By that point, are they family or are they members of his species, his race? Like, what at what point does that change? And then, of course, the spoilers for the first couple episodes of season 5 of Star Trek Discovery. The first episode, we meet Fred, another Soong-type android who's lived hundreds of years and looks very much like Data, right? Like, is he a member of the family? Is he part of Data's race? Like, what? How do we classify that? But I'm curious about this phenomenon, and I like the way you put it, that Data is, there's a part of him in all of these. Like, all of these people contributed to Data, therefore we see Data in all of them. And especially the Soongs, where they look exactly the same throughout history for some reason. Doctor of genetics in the 21st century, you say, could there be something there? But I think that makes sense in the metaphor that you've brought up, where like there's little pieces of us in members of our family and pieces of them in us in turn. And you see certain things, like people always say, wow, you look so much like your mother to me, until they meet my father. And then they're like, oh damn, he looks exactly like his father. Like, I've gotten used to hearing that, and not quite as exact as Data looks like Nguni and Soong, obviously, but you know, there's still those touchstones there that I think we as viewers kind of latch on to and realize, like, oh, he's just like us. And I think that's a kind of clever shorthand. It's interesting that this android, this piece of technology, we've met more of his family, I think, than any other single character in Star Trek. I can't think of anyone that comes close.
I would argue no. And getting to know who Data is through getting to know his quote unquote family. And maybe even, I'm going to get rid of the quotes. We don't need that. He does have a family, and that family exists through time and space and different variations and iterations. And I think, you know, to be able to reflect on Data as characterized and reflect on how he is handled and dealt with throughout this entire series of Star Trek. Again, what really gets underscored to me is that Star Trek isn't the discovery of strange new worlds and stuff like that. It's a journey into the human condition, right? It always has been, and it always will be, actually a story about humanity and our, you know, they say that history isn't an account of the past. It's merely a reflection of the present in a lot of ways. Well, I just showed my students images from 1899, what people thought 1999 would look like. And if you Google that, you'll find it. And it's a lot of airships and a lot of people who are dressed exactly like you would be more or less in that time, in our, you know, where we were in 1999, doing things that, you know, though we think it's amusing and funny, there are actually some pretty strong predictions, right? The idea that my favorite one is a bunch of books being put into what looks like a giant meat grinder, and it's got a wire attached, and there's a child turning this lever, grinding all these books together, and there's a bunch of other children sitting in desks with headphones on, right? And I mean, sure, that's not how it looked, but like if you think about how we try to consolidate information into technology, that's pretty much right on the money, right? If you think about a lot of the educational strategies through technology, we really haven't changed much. We still utilize the industrial model. Kids still use tablets. It's just they're a lot more shiny now. And that's about it. So as much as their vision of the future is more of a reflection of their present, and I would argue the same thing with Star Trek, we have to understand that the certain essence of the human family is explored in Star Trek very, very carefully. And I think it's treated very well. And, you know, we might rail on some of the writers for some of the choices they make and everything else. I do think that sort of underlying core of what Star Trek truly is probably best exemplified through the story of Data, Spock, and Worf specifically. And they're kind of a trinity to me of what it means to be human. And it's all of these characters who aren't quite human.
and they give us the best understanding. It's almost like the outsider effect that you get, that observer effect that makes you understand humanity more so, right? As you mentioned, Worf is the born-again Klingon. Spock resents his humanity in so many ways, and all Data wants is his humanity. And you know, we started this episode with that quote where he and Spock are interacting with each other, which, again, I think is a fantastic way to explore how each character is approaching their humanity, because they both have it and they both are part of a larger family, right? I guess, you know, to think about it, who has the next biggest family in Star Trek? It would be Spock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you meet his children, kind of, you meet his brother, you meet, not his children, sorry, you meet his, you meet siblings mm-hmm. in certain ways, not children, duh. You meet his father, you meet his brother, you meet his mother, and they're all kind of lost at certain points as well, right? I'll never forget when in 2009 Trek, Zachary Quinto expertly plays Spock in the moment when he loses his mother in the destruction of Vulcan. And you'll actually notice there's a production choice that was made where they actually enlarged his eyes to make them look more childish. You'll see, once you see it, you can't unsee it. They definitely computer generated his eyeballs to make them look a little bit bigger and childify his face a bit more as he's lost her. That's on purpose. And it's very interesting. And then, of course, when his father comes and says, you know, like, why did you marry Mom? And he's like, I married her because I loved her. And he just turns around and walks away. You're just like, oh, snap. Like, there is a humanity here, and it's aliens talking about it, right? Mm-hmm. It's very important to not let that go. And so I think, though maybe we can think of it as kind of a cute little cliche that all of Data's ancestors looked exactly like him, and that's actually not how genetics works, and all of that sort of stuff, I think the vibe, the persona of Data is inexorably connected to the story of Star Trek, which is an exploration of the story of humanity.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't have put it better myself. But I do wonder if there was a plan or a thought that, like, you know, going from the deep philosophical things that you were just talking about to the to the purely surface level appearance of things that I'm about to talk about, you know, with Adam Soong and Eric Soong being geneticists, I wonder if they were meant to just be clones. Like, he was cloning a daughter, right? Corey Soong. So are the Soongs just all genetic copies of each other throughout history?
So Data is either an android or an aphid? Abiogenesis. Interesting. Well, let's get into Data coming on back, just like Superman did.
Mm-hmm.
Except he didn't have a mullet like Superman in the comic books did when he came back, which in hindsight, I found extremely cringe.
I will note that at the end of season one, after Data's second death, Brent Spiner did an interview in which he said that was the last time he would ever play Data again.
And I do very much recall that happening once before when Leonard Nimoy said this exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he directed the next movie.
And I think Brent Spiner also said it after Nemesis, probably.
Oh, almost certainly. Like, whatever. I guess, you know, glib, I think, is just how we need to take the death of any character in any franchise that is as beloved as Star Trek, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, unless it's Game of Thrones or or The Expanse, they're coming back.
Yeah.
And look at, you know, like, really quick diversion. I couldn't get through the second season of Game of Thrones for the fact that no characters were ever permanent, and it was really hard to hang on to anybody for me, right? Those of you who love the series and think it's all the best and super good, like, no judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And weirdly, I made it through the entirety of the Expanse franchise. And even though you lost some characters, but I noticed they kind of like dialed back the main character death stuff by the end of the Expanse. Whereas I felt they kept that up in Game of Thrones moving forward. And of course I watched it more from a peripheral sense after the second season, just because it kind of made me depressed. Mm-hmm. But that's okay. That. That's a me thing. That totally is a me thing.
It's the pendulum swing, right? Like, on the one end of the pendulum, you've got no characters ever die and everyone's completely safe all the time, even when they die.
Right.
And on the other side of the pendulum swing, you've got the, like, I feel unmoored and uncertain because this world is too dangerous and too, like, I'm afraid to get close to anything because at any moment it could be snatched away from me. And like, that drama works for me if I'm in the right place, and it works for a lot of people if they're in the right place and the right mind space for that. But it's sometimes really hard to deal with. Both sides of that pendulum are very hard to deal with. Like when a character comes back five times or something, I understand the frustration. I get how like it feels like there's no stakes. It feels like this is just, you know, a video game with unlimited lives. And like, what's the point? Yeah.
Exactly. So, I guess, and maybe this is the last little piece of it, and we can kind of start to gear down the discussion on Data's second approach that we get in the third season of Picard, where he is now sort of an amalgamation of his iterations through an android Soong, where you meet Lol, you meet Lore, you meet B4, and you meet Data, and especially with Lore and Data, they are in a type of kind of multiple personality conflict with one another. And I think it's treated really well, right? It's utilized to get control of the plot in a lot of ways, where Data and Lore's fight with one another does actually hinge on the survival of the crew in a lot of ways, taking control of the ship and everything like that. But I want to ask, I'm sure most people are familiar with the Ship of Theseus analogy, where there's a guy who owns a boat and it's the Ship of Theseus and that's his name. And every couple of years he's replacing boards on the ship because wood decays. And it gets to the point where he removes the last original board and puts on a new board because it's rotten and he needs to replace it. Is that still the same ship? Mm-hmm. Right? And in a physical sense, you can argue kind of in a very straightforward scientific sense, well, no, it's not. These are different pieces of wood that are still in the same configuration of that original ship, but it's not the same. And I think a lot of people find that difficult to swallow, and much, much manifested in our pop culture. I think that nostalgia and an aversion to change has kind of permeated and somewhat poisoned our understanding of the world. And I think an adherence to not ever wanting to change, not ever wanting to embrace certain change, and being quite averse and insecure when it comes to change, it's manifested very much in the wish fulfillment of our popular culture. And so one thing that I really, really liked about how they treated Data in this sense is he still dies in the first season to me. This isn't the same Data. In fact, the way Data defeats Lore is not by resisting and overcoming him. It is by absorbing him. It is by taking those aspects of Lore and internalizing them, taking them in, and becoming what I could argue as a completely new individual. And any human being who has lived more than a couple of years needs to understand that that is exactly what life is. You are not the same person, right? What do they say about cells in the human body? That we've shed basically all of them after about 7 or 8 years or so?
Absolutely.
There's also the idea that the fauna, the gut flora or whatever you have in your stomach and intestinal tract, there's actually more bacterium in your body than there are cells that make you up. And so who are you? And those bacteria can actually affect your personality and your behavior to some degree.
Mm-hmm. I've always wondered if like alien beings visiting Earth would like scan us and say, oh, there's some sort of colony species that like all work. Yeah. Like, would we have our understanding of what we are fundamentally shifted by, mm-hmm. It's the analogy of the fish in the water doesn't know that its environment is water. We don't know we're colony species of all these things until something from the outside says like, oh, that's weird. That's what you are.
Well, I'm reminded of Orson Scott Card, a science fiction writer for Ender's Game, where he depicts an alien species that the way they communicate is by altering your DNA. And unfortunately, it kills humans to do that. So their mode of communication is actually like hostile and destructive, though that's not necessarily their actual intent. I think it does kind of scratch that itch of change that we rarely want to even approach. And I mean, I think it's because death is hard and scary and that change is uncertain. But if you think about the story of the human species over time, really adapting and letting change us is basically how we've survived as a species, right? And trying to keep things as they are is actually sometimes to our detriment, right? I mean, going way off topic, I mean, the way Canada manages its national park system by trying to keep it static and unchanging is why the pine beetle and fire is now one of the worst threats to their management. And when you go back to how at least the way I understand indigenous people would utilize fire and destruction to actually preserve and protect. We ignore that at our peril, and seeing things as static and unchanging is actually kind of an inhuman way of doing things. You will have to use violence to maintain that status quo, and that gets us into some really dark and sticky territory. So I really love the way they handled Data here, because it is that idea of, no, Lore, I'm not going to resist you. I'm actually going to embrace you. And by embracing you, we both kind of win. You don't have to defeat me. You become me, and I become you. And I think that's really nifty. And I mean, final thought on this, like, isn't that what you and I are? You and I are an amalgamation of two people, are we mm-hmm. not? And therefore an amalgamation of a ton of people who came before them.
Absolutely.
Right? So what are we really, right? So there's my deep philosophical thought on why I like Data's second approach, and actually don't think it does anything to negate the season one Picard death of Data. That was a different thing altogether.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think they struck a really nice balance. And it's interesting you put it in terms of static and unchanging versus evolution and growth. I feel like they did this thing where you could see it either way if you want. Like, it's kind of like a choose your own adventure for Star Trek fans. If all you care about, if you are one of those people that wants things to not change and be the same, hey, Data's back. Cool. Everyone's all together. We have Data. You don't have to think about it more than that if you don't want to. But going deeper and seeing that, yeah, he has taken in Lol before, and especially Lore, and what that means. And if you really want to delve into that, there's that there too. And I think that's really great. And I also really appreciate, like you said, it doesn't negate what happened in season one. In fact, they directly shout that out in an episode, right, where Picard asks him about that. He's like, Data, I need to ask, when I talked to you before, you were very wanting to die. And like, how are you feeling about this? And he basically says that Data did want to die, and that Data is gone. But as I am now, this version of me, I don't want to. I want to live. We both get what we want. And mm-hmm. I thought that was really great. That was, again, a way to kind of have both outcomes and satisfy them. And, you know, a good writer can make that feel satisfying. And I think that's what they did. So there's a lot to enjoy about this new version of Data. The other thing that I appreciate about it is last episode, when we were talking about this, I said, like, I always had this idea of Data as this eternal being, or at least as, you know, much closer to eternal than us humans can comprehend, who lives hundreds of years and sees eons and different things. And mm-hmm. that possibility is back now again. So, like, Data, I guess, could show up in the 32nd century in Discovery. And, like, it was great to see a Sung type android in the 32nd century that had lived for, you know, at least over 700 years. That was very cool. I don't know that I'd want necessarily a Data cameo. I think that would be a little bit much, but the possibility exists that he's out there. And I think that opens the door for some clever writer to do some really interesting things, should they so choose.
Yeah, well, I've got a thought to you where I've been thinking about you saying, like, this individual kind of moving forward through history from his inception in TNG onward, the way he's characterized in prequel series and so on, and in further series when they travel back in time, you actually start realizing that Data was there all along through his ancestors.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases. So he is actually sort of a timeless individual. We just know one of his avatars very closely and very intimately, but Data was actually there before Data, if you really think about it. Kind of like your essences to some degree were there before you, and they will be there after you as well, because, you know, genetics and family and behavior and yada, yada, yada. And again, it makes you start to realize that, you know, what does it mean to be human? Of course, you know, we are in Western society obsessed with our individuality. We need to start embracing the collective sense of what it means to be human too. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately is where I would say I can kind of close my talk on Data, in the sense that he is very much the sum of his parts, more than specifically a singular individual character who we experience. He is a vibe. And I think it's great to get into the Data vibe.
Absolutely. You know, it occurs to me that if Time's Arrow were made today, Data would be back in time in 1800 San Francisco and run into Samsung living there at that time.
Of course. Yeah, he'd bump into him, and that Sung would probably admonish him for bumping into him. and he would have some kind of matter-of-fact response.
Yeah. And of course, he'd be played by Brent Spiner. So,
Of course. Yeah. Well, mad props to Brent Spiner, especially in season three, who was capable of changing his facial expressions and tone of voice and cadence and everything literally on a dime.
Absolutely.
Where he would be going from either of these characters, you know, as we kind of give him a bit of a hard time for his glibness as a human being, as an actual person, he is an extremely talented actor. And I think we are fortunate to have someone so creative and dedicated to a role to bring him in. And so, mad props to you, Brent. You're a treasure and kind of a goofball, and we love you for it.
Definitely. Do you think we've seen the last of Brent Spiner in Star Trek now?
No. No. Okay. As long as they don't keep canceling franchises, I do think we will see Brent Spiner again, you know, much like we'll see Michael Dorn again and a number of other characters. I think we will be seeing them and you know, I mean, Frakes, right? Jonathan Frakes, in front of or behind the camera, you can tell when he's around, right? Even when he's directing, you get that Frakesian feel. And it's something that I really enjoy. So no, these characters have really made this series their own. And I want to see Gates McFadden. I want to see Marina Sirtis come back. They have a vibe too. And it's something that that I enjoy and really love.
Interesting little piece of trivia, just mentioning that if Jonathan Frakes does not somehow magically appear in one of the remaining episodes of Star Trek Discovery, that will be the first Star Trek series that Jonathan Frakes has not appeared on screen in since Star Trek The Next Generation.
Well, shiver me timbers. But he's still been involved.
He's still been involved, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was actually the second episode of Discovery this season. There's that famous little blooper, apparently. I haven't seen it, but I've seen screen caps where the director can be seen in the bushes in one scene. So. Oh, yeah. Jonathan Frakes, I'm assuming, has directed an episode this season. Maybe he made a similar gaffe.
Yeah, he's in the reflection of something. He's in a lens flare, and there he was. Well, let's hope for that then.
Yes, absolutely.
That if he's not going to come on intentionally, that we unintentionally get like a Jonathan Frakes Bigfoot sighting some kind. Hear, hear. Well, with that, everyone, we're happy that you've hung on this long to listen to us pontificate on the vast and broad character that is Data. Of course, if you have more to say, feel free to pop on to our Facebook chat, or you can email us as well. So with that, we hope you have fun exploring the vibe that is Data, and live long and prosper and stay positive.
Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.